I knew I was a fairly intelligent lad, and I knew in general what was going on. And I never felt the least bit embittered at all. And it was the right thing, in my opinion, to go ahead. Of course, I was not happy about our well going dry and having to do all that work. But I went ahead and did it. That was my assignment. And in those days, a large family was an asset. Well, I was happened to be the only boy, and I got all the man jobs to do, the male jobs. The girls would wash the dishes and take the cows off and water them and things like that. We were self-contained, had our own milk and butter, and raised our own beef and our pigs and hams and everything. So we bought sugar and coffee, but we had plenty of other from plantations.
What about that story about the man that you saw ride down through Palmerville?
Oh, that was, he was an electrical engineer who had charge of building out of granite a small powerhouse up at Whitney. That was, and I thought it must be wonderful to have his ability. Well, that's 3 miles up. He roomed up at Mr. and Mrs. Bostwick. They were an old couple that had no children. They had plenty of room. And he had a very fine black saddle horse, which he rode, and I saw him time after time going up and down the road, supervising the construction. And his name, I even remember his name, was Wright, W-R-I-G-H-T. He was an electrical engineer. He worked on that job. It took them a couple of years. They were going, that was from the electricity they were going to generate. Now, they had a dam made out of solid granite, which came from Granite Quarry, about 18 miles up toward Salisbury, 18, 20 miles from here. And that diverted, apparently, for the original little powerhouse, which was perfectly fine. But it's miniature as compared to what happened subsequently. But Mr. Wright rode, it took them about 3 years to build that little powerhouse. They needed the power for Whitney. And wherever they needed power, and that's the way they got it, there was no way. We didn't have electricity in this house. And we didn't have electricity in 1913, because I remember my father bought a Delco system, which generated enough for lights. He was the first man to have lit lights in this village, but it was a Delco system. You ran a little engine, you'd prime it with gasoline, and then you'd run it by kerosene, which was 15 cents a gallon. And you could, about a gallon and a half would generate enough electricity and store it in the batteries to light all this big house and the school and the dormitories, which then existed. And for about 30 cents a week.
Well, you said the other day that seeing this Mr. Wright on his big black horse signified something to you.
Well, it was a picture of success, I thought. I thought that I would hope that sometime that I would grow up to be an important man, that I could have a horse that I could ride. and up and down the road and look as important as I thought he was. He was an inspiration to me. Although he was not my ideal of a man as an individual, but he had accomplished something. And I felt that I wanted to accomplish something sometime like that.
You said earlier that it was sort of a revolution here when George Whitney first came with the idea of the dam.
Yes, it was. It was, a rather rapid transition from a completely rural atmosphere to what was a very noisy and big industrial development. And it's somewhat of a shock, you know. A lot of people object to that. I never objected to it. My father always thought, well, you don't stand in the way of progress. And he was a very forward-looking man, and he recognized that there was some good in everything, but then there's also some bad. But he was, a very interesting development which he lived with for a much longer period than I, because after 1913, I wasn't here but a few days at the time.
Well, how would you describe that era now as you look back on it?
How would I describe that? Well, it was the creation of a new era, a complete change from the old. And it was something that signified, and I recognized at the time, signified progress. And I got a job in the as a common laborer so I could go into the plant. This was about summer of about 1916, and war had broken out in Europe, and it looked as if we might have trouble, and there was great demand for aluminum. You had to have a pass if you got in to see how they did it. And I thought the easiest way to get a pass is go down there and say, I want a job. They needed labor. I just took a common labor job. And I made $1.50 a day as an electrician's helper. But I saw how they produced aluminum and the equipment and everything that they... I was very interested. I wanted to know what was going on there. And I liked what I saw. And they had a beautiful office building built up there, and I was just a freshman in college, and I thought to myself, gee, if I could just get me a job and get in that nice office up there and make $100 a month, I'd be fixed. Well, I never got that job, but I got a laborer's job because I wanted to know how it was done.
Could you tell that story about what you learned from your foreman?
Yes. Part of my duty, the aluminum company was then in the midst of a substantial expansion program, and they were putting up steel frame buildings, and they were, at that time, they would bolt these tremendous beams together, And my job was to saw off the end of the bolt that protruded beyond the nut that held it in place, take a file and file it off smoothly so that it would look nice. And I worked a couple of days sawing the hacksaw and a hand file until I decided, well, there must be a better way to do that. So I went down to the shop on my own and requisitioned an enormous bolt cutter, which was a great pair of shears made especially to cut steel bolts. And I thought that was great. So I cut all the bolts off first, then I got my file and started to file the end off smoothly. And after the second day, the boss came around to inspect to see what I was doing. I had done everything, the whole building pretty nearly. And he said, why don't you do this the way I told you to? Well, I thought this would be much faster and much cheaper. That's not the way I want you to do it. I want you to do it the way I told you to. Saw it off with a hacksaw and file it down smoothly. I said, well, I don't quite understand. He says, my job is, I did a very fine job for you. Oh, yeah, that was all right, but you see, it's like this. I have a half a dozen men on my crew, and what you're doing, you're working yourself out of a job and me out of a job. I won't have anything to do if you do cut all these things by machinery the way you're doing it. I said, okay, I understand. From then on, I went back and sawed them off by hand and killed time, knowing it didn't mean anything. One of the finest illustrations that I've ever had. I've thought of it thousands of times in the course of my business career. How wasteful it was, you know, how wasteful labor is at times. And sometimes they want to just keep things like so they'll have prolong the job, and the work and the money, even regardless of cost.
Could you say something about where the laborers came from during the construction days?
Well, we had quite a bit of colored labor, but the supervisory labor was all white. The white supervisory labor was pretty high class. They could make $5 to $10 a day. You know, they were well paid. That for those days, it was real hard money, and that might be as much as $100 a day now for a man who operates a hog shovel, and that might have composed maybe 10%, you know, of the labor force. I'm just estimating now. Then you had another strata of that was common labor. They might have been farm boys from around this place, around the village, and from the surrounding country. If you have a place where you can make $1.50 or $2 a day, you drive a horse and wagon, ride a horse 5 or 6 miles in order to get to your job. So labor came in from around all over. And you had some Italian labor. And there wasn't anything the matter, it was just common labor, but they were very, some of them were very fine people, doubtless, but very low grade of labor. They couldn't speak English, but there were quite a few of them. And I know a lady had married a good friend of ours, was a descendant of. She's a very, very cultured and refined person. We were very fond of one of our neighbors. She was attacking. They raised a family right over here, and the house was owned by my aunt for a while. Well, labor came in from all around. They used some, in the construction of the dam down on the river, they used some convict labor. And they under supervision. Well, they had to be under guards, and they had to work and wear the convict uniform. But that was better than having them stay in just in the jailhouses and feed them up, feed them all the time and for nothing. I think it paid the state something for them. But I know they did have some convict, but most of it was free labor. Yeah.
When you went to work at the Tallahassee Power Company, was that the first public work that you ever had?
First job I ever had, first paying job I ever had. I made $1.50 a day.
Did people use the term public work?
Public works? Mm-hmm. Yes. Public works could cover a vast area. But that was the term they used. Father preferred to do his own thing in his own way instead of going off, as he would say, as a public works where you're just a figurehead. They were referred to, they wouldn't reduct as public works. You had a great deal of the public in it. And that was the time to use, whether it was right or wrong. But now you go to work in the factory, that's not public works. I mean, that's a different proposition. We had developed at the same time a large textile industry in Albemarle in Norway. And the early days, before our laws prohibiting it, they used child labor. They were delighted to have a place where they could to make 10 cents an hour. And children would learn to operate these textile machines, teach them. And father was very much opposed to it because he thought that all children should be free to have a good education. He was an educational man. Yeah.
Was there any child labor?
No child labor laws at that time to prohibit it. Later on, the child labor laws were enacted, which prohibited child labor. It interfered with the growth and development and the education of the children. It's a good thing. But they didn't think it was wrong. The people didn't think it was wrong. The children thought it was great. And of course, the owner of the cotton mill thought it was great. He was getting cheap labor and getting richer for the minute. But it was not good to have children 9, 10 years old going into a factory and it's interfering with the really the proper development of their lives.
Where did the convict laborers live? Where did they sleep?
I think they had a barbed wire prison and a guard standing over them all the time, out in tents, out near the. That was a minor part of the labor they used, but I mentioned that as incidental. It was they did use some common labor.
How about the free labor? Where did they live?
Well, they came from all around, 5 or 6 miles around. They'd drive in and. The colored labor would walk. There's a little colored town over the west here, and where most of the colored people live then and now, and they would walk to Whitney. 3 miles is not such a bad walk, particularly if you can make $1.50, $2 a day. They were getting nothing before, and they were glad of the opportunity to work. And the industrial developers did them a favor because we have too many colored people and poorly schooled people, ill-trained, walking around doing nothing on welfare, whereas if they had a job to do, they could be doing something creative. Instead of being destructive of capital, what we're doing now, we're just burning our capital up, having too much idleness. People don't want to work, won't work when they don't have to.
Was there a school for black children in the area?
Were there black children? Mm-hmm. Yes. Yeah, there were a great many, and I guess we had the black population was on the back side of our plantation over a mile from here. It was probably larger than the white. My father thought that they should have be taught to read and write, educate them, whether black or white, because an educated citizen, educated person makes a better citizen. And he worked very hard all of his life to help to educate blacks and whites.
Did you have black students in the Yadkin Mineral Springs Academy?
That didn't occur in those days. There was a complete segregation, and they didn't live in Palmerville, and they had to go to the colored section to live. They didn't go to school to Palmerville, but my father was county superintendent of schools among his many other duties. And he inspired the older colored people to help to build get a schoolhouse. He'd build a one-room schoolhouse, and they would have a colored teacher to come in who had enough education, teach them how to read and write. See, and I don't think I've ever seen but a few, but I've seen. My father, when I was a boy, pointed out so-and-so and so-and-so, he can't read and write. Pitiful. Pitiful, you'd say.
Was that a town called Julep Town where they lived?
No.
No,
Julep Town rings a bell with me, but I'm not sure. I don't think I've heard that term. It's been used, applied somewhere around here, but I'm not familiar with it. It's a Tulip Town is, my concept is one where you kick up your heels, have a lot of drinking, singing, dancing going on. But it's, well, we had enough, we had on the weekends, Saturday night, you'd have a lot of drinking and going on. But this area down below, from here down for half a mile down to the canal, it's called Smoky Hollow. And it was filled with people. It would be, they'd come to eat and drink and be merry and shoot the pistols, and sometimes somebody would get hurt, killed, and was wounded. That was a catastrophe, because in my younger days, nobody got shot at or did any shooting. But this was the Wild West, and the men wore their guns on the belt outside and tried to act like Wild Westerners.
Is there anything else you would like to say in summary about those years, or about the Whitney Company, or the French?
No. The Whitney Company was pretty much a history, and the Tallahassee Power Company was a going outfit, but there's nothing really. You had the same economic influences affecting the area as you have in any developing area. That well, for example, I remember I never had, we never thought about it. Somebody's, a neighbor wanted me to go to Whitney 3 miles by the railroads and bring a trunk down for them that had been shipped to them and carried to the house and put it on my porch. Well, I'll have time, I'll get to that, I can do it tomorrow. Can't do it today, but I'll do it tomorrow. And you wouldn't think of charging me for anything. But I did that for one of the upper echelon people who probably made them $7 to $10 a day. And he gave me 50 cents. He insisted that I take 50 cents. And I'd spent 2.5 hours to go and come and deliver his trunk for him. I thought that was phenomenal. I didn't charge him. I was taught not to. This, you had to be enabling. But this didn't take long to get over that, though.
Well, how do you feel about Governor Hunt and others attracting international industry to North Carolina?
I think I have been not in the state now, but I came down here in 1976, 77, and I didn't know anything about the politics, but I heard Governor Hunt to make talks on television on the North Carolina program, places like that, and I had gotten a very favorable impression of the job the governor has done for the state. And my wife and I, we sit together, and I didn't even know whether he's Republican or Democrat. But she said, "I like Governor Hunt. I like what he's saying and doing." And well, there's politics and everything. Some criticize him now for doing too much, going too much in certain directions and not enough in others, but they want a job.
Okay. Anything else you want to say about the French
Company? No, I'm just trying to help you. You've got a job to do, and I'm just trying to...